Yeah. Thanks, Bettina. Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our conference call for the results of the first quarter 2012. As always, Oliver will present the key facts and figures to you. Without further ado, I hand over directly to him.
Good afternoon, everybody. We had a good quarter. I'm going to lead you through the Q1 numbers, and I'll enjoy them as long as they are great. Given the environment, we'll have some tough times ahead. Let's talk about the things that went well in the first quarter, and I will try to hit some of the questions I have seen in the early commentary that came out right up front. The second comment I'd like to make, I'm trying to be brief, but I'd also like the questions to be pointed on the explanations and the economic drivers. We have provided a lot of technical answers in the appendix, particularly on the internal model changes which we have implemented in Q1. Oliver Schmidt will, after this call, be very happy to address any technical items around that, like how come this number moves this and that, because I think that's a better use of our time here on this call. Let's dive into the deck. I'm going to start on page three with the main highlights. Revenue is 30.1 billion. While life is down, this still is the second-best quarter we have had. Operating profit 40% up to 2.3 billion. Lower net cat losses have helped, but also a very strong performance in asset management, life, health. Net income at 1.4 billion, and capital position continues to be very strong while we are doing everything we can to further de-risk it in parallel. Page four gives you the usual overview over the last nine quarters, gives you a nice feel for the Q1 results. Page five gives you the equity development and the growth in the book capital to 48.2 billion, 7.4 billion up. Net income plays a role. FX was actually slightly negative with -200. Unrealized gains and losses significantly up 2.1 billion and a few other items that add up to this number. The stress impact on the right-hand side are as usual, so I will not spend a lot of time on it. Page number six, the for the next at least 2 years relevant conglomerate solvency rules show that we have very strong solvency, 183, going up further. Now, we all know it's not sensitive to interest rates, so it's a partially interesting perspective from an economic standpoint. In terms of regulatory capital, we are and will remain extremely strong. Page number seven give you our economic solvency at Solvency II calibration. I spent a lot of time last year to prepare you for the changes we have done in Q1. A couple of comments on that. Number one, we have implemented a whole slew of changes that are aimed at trying to bring us as much as possible in line with the current Solvency II discussion. We're taking a very close look at what is in the text that has gone through the econ and have applied it. Second, we did it in the first quarter in order to not create uncertainty about our Q4 numbers, so we've lumped them together in order to prepare ourselves. Last comment, however, we will only know what the real deal is once we have gotten an internal model approval, which is a year after the trilogue has ended. We're currently planning our approval process to start for the internal model application in the middle of 2013, and that's when we will exactly know what the regulators will approve of and not. Until then, sorry guys, there is still some insecurity. Now, second comment is a lot of people have said, "Ooh, that looks great, but the markets have been terrible the second quarter. Will that number not have suffered dramatically?" I cannot tell you the number as of today, but we're getting better on the system side every week. As of May 7th, that solvency number still stands at 195, which is really strong. Last comment before I go into the number, the most important sensitivity remains the combination of low interest rates and equity markets. With the bonds kissing 1.5%, we're already in a very, very difficult situation. Now, let me move to page number eight, where we have provided you with the transparency around what makes the numbers move between year-end and now. There are two components. The right-hand side shows you the Q1 movements, which is typically benign market IFRS earnings. and on the risk capital side, increasing risk exposure and decreasing valuation rates due to lower liquidity premium. I'd also like to point out that liquidity premium have come down significantly, and therefore those of you that hated this thing in the first place will know that this more reflects what you always thought were the true economics. Factually, we had 96 basis points liquidity premium in Q4 and has come down to 59 basis points as of now. Yeah, so it's almost halved. Now, the left-hand side shows the major movements, both on AFR and risk capital. And I've seen some comments that said we've taken a lot of positive, but no negative. That's obviously nonsense. On page number 69, we have provided you, and I think we're leading disclosure here in the industry, with what has really moved the impact and what have been the various model changes. All the ratios are as of the end of last year, so you can really go through the numbers. And I'd like to point out that we've done three major items to be on the more conservative side. The first one is we have introduced transferability restrictions for the value of in-force of life portfolios, and also where we have minorities, limited that to the risk-bearing capacity. The second one is we have become a lot more conservative given what we're seeing with the Fed rates and with the bonds on interest rate modeling. The external calibrations, which were too benign, we've used and now use our own statistical time series again, which are stressing interest rates a lot more than the official data. And then a third one is we have introduced life non-market risk modeling in line with Solvency II requirements, explicitly modeling even more conservatively longevity risk. So we're trying to buffer up and make sure that, particularly on the life insurance side, we are not just taking the gains, in particular from yield curve anchoring at year 20 and then off the swap curve and then moving to the ultimate rate at year 60, or, for example, by the full integration of our operational risk model that were so far based on an approach that's more like the S&P standard formulas but does not reflect the things we are doing to improve and run operational risk. The asset management side, last comment, we've also had a charge on that that was not reflecting our true bottom-up model. I can only applaud our colleagues. I think we have a much better understanding of what it is, and we're not just having one of the best asset management shops, but we also have one of the best risk management shops and asset management, and that is reflected here. So let me move back to page number 8 and then say what is it? So we had a net decline in interest rate risk modeling, a lot of life non-market risk, operational risk integration, and revised asset management modeling, bringing the number from 26.7 billion to 24.2. And at the same time, we also had a net negative effect out of the decrease to non-transferability and partially offsetting by the euro swap extrapolation from 20 years onwards. Now, well, before people get too excited and say, this is fantastic, now we'll get a lot more dividends out of Allianz, let me please remind you that we have other capital regimes we also need to pay attention to. In particular, the credit agencies have the desire to constantly downgrade European sovereigns, and the banks sometimes by the way, arguing that you need to downgrade the one because you just downgraded the other one. And that is putting, obviously, pressure on ratings. Since we are exposed to both financial sector ratings and government ratings, we have had our risk capital relief that we've produced by de-risking, about $1 billion in the first quarter, seen offset by charges through higher charges from Standard & Poor's and others due to the downgrade. So we are net neutral despite significant risk reduction, and that will remain somewhat of a boundary condition going forward. So before you get too excited about dividend increases, let's get through the year and see how the euro crisis continues to unfold. Now, page 10, please. Revenues development, a couple of comments here. On an internal growth basis, P&C are both from prices and volume. Life health down 5%. I'll talk about it, particularly due to the situation in Italy where we had very, very slow sales on the bancassurance side, and asset management continues to power ahead with 8.4% on an internal basis. Notionally, it's actually 13%, and very strong net inflows after outflows in the first quarter, which also differs from the industry. Page number 11 shows you that all the business segments are doing well. We have one issue that's the corporate segment. I need to explain that to you. That's on page number 12. Two declines, one in the banking side. It's not Germany banking. It's AGF Bank, where we had a guarantee we provided for the life insurance side on Greek government debt. After the exchange, we've taken the net hit to the P&L, so that's a non-recurring item. And on the holding treasury side, we have about 18 million more investment income, typically dividend income from our financial investments, and 29 million in technology investments in the first quarter. Now, moving on to non-operating items, a couple of comments on the realized gains and loss position. Net number minus 7 for the quarter. The right-hand side shows you the various components. Two comments here on the equity side. Last year, we still had ICB gains in that we don't have this year, and we had some debt changes and realizations in the first quarter, particularly to de-risk. On the impairment side, there is a 125 charge on equities. The vast majority of that, 75 million to be precise, is the write-down on our Spanish bank participation, Banco Popular. We've taken in time and through the market. In difference to all other strategic positions, that position we could not hedge due to the illiquidity in the market. All other positions, UCI, Commerce Bank, and others, we are hedging or making sure to reduce them. Now, the other component that I'd like to mention is the income from financial assets and liabilities carried at fair value, the second to last line. The vast majority of that is 180 million gain on the sale of the Hartford warrants. Let me remind you, the debentures will come in the second quarter, and we haven't decided yet, just to preempt the question, what we do with the shares. We're evaluating our options as the year unfolds. I'd like to close the comments on this page by pointing out that our unrealized gains, both on equity and fixed income, have gone up substantially, and we have refrained, as always, from taking extra gains just to produce some earnings. Now, let's move on to the sovereigns. I think this is now the eighth quarter where I have the pleasure to talk about this. Greece is basically irrelevant. Ireland is irrelevant. Portugal is irrelevant. For those that have a question, we've been also continuously selling down whatever we have, 300, 400 million on Portugal and Ireland. We've sold Spain further down with the appropriate position. We continue to de-risk where there is market liquidity, and we will continue to do so going forward. The unrealized gains position have obviously improved in the first quarter. The second quarter will see the reversal of the trend, but it's still significantly better than in Q3 and Q4. Page 15, net income development. There's still always a question, why is the effective tax rate so high? Two comments. We had, again, lower tax-exempt income in Q1, and we have trade taxes and prior year taxes that you need to pay, keep in mind. So, for example, on the Hartford warrants, we not just had to pay tax on the Hartford sale, but also on the dilution payment that we received, I think, in 2009, 200 million, we needed to pay extra taxes on because at that time we were assumed to hold and then convert the warrants. Now that we've sold, that had to be unwound. That tax rate is expected to trend down over the year. We have a plan of around 33.5% for the total year. So these would have been my comments for the group section. Let's please move on to P&C. And there were a couple of questions in particular around the accident year loss ratio, which I'm going to address in a second. So to start with page 18, you see, I think, overall a nice picture, except for Eastern Europe and for Spain. We're growing everywhere, obviously at different rates. In Spain, we all need to acknowledge that there's a very severe recession, but I can tell you we have the strongest balance sheet there and the strongest franchise, and we will continue to make significant profit in this market. And given our low fixed cost base, we can actually afford to let top line grow, go, and protect the margin. Now, in France, we are flat on the quarter. We expect slight growth this year. As for Germany, in both cases, however, we're still growing through prices. We also now need to make sure that we grow through on the unit side. A number of other places are growing very nicely. Just to explain, AGCS is somewhat of a one-off through our ART unit. It's not something you can prorate over the year. It will normalize over the year. And we have a number of markets where we are catching up due to very strong price increases, for example, in Australia. And we have one comment I have to make on credit insurance. We've actually decreased prices. I mentioned that in the year-end call. And it's actually enlarging the market space and attracting customer volume. So I sometimes see a little bit, simplistic analysis that say if the prices don't go up, volume doesn't go up. It's not true. In a number of markets where we've taken prices down, we see significantly more growth. And that's wherever we have good margins, that's actually the right thing to do. Now, operating profit, page number 19, the huge improvement through underwriting, and that is obviously driven by very low net cat. We had 700 million less net cat than last year, which was terrible. And we have some profitability gains in a number of large markets, which we really like, particularly in Italy and France. Now, partially is that offset by negative runoff from prior net cat. It was in the footnotes. We have about 80 million additional negative runoff from Thailand. It just took a very, very, very long time to have business disruption claims coming from third-party reinsurance business to the corporate center, and that's reflected in the numbers that you see here. That also suppresses the runoff numbers to what you saw in the first quarter. With that, let me move on page 20. Yeah, overall, a very, very good picture, except for the United States, where we're still running at around 106 for the year. The question always is the U.S. going to be better? I told you at the end of the year, 2012 is the year of restructuring, so the Fireman's Fund numbers will not dramatically improve throughout the year. We have taken significant reserving action. We will continue to do so. The market continues to be tough, particularly in workers' compensation and property. So that's it. In a number of other places, Germany, France, Italy, particularly Italy, we have fantastic profitability. If you compare that to our competitors, we're probably 5 to 6 points at least better than everybody else. Spain, outstanding results, as we have them in AGC and as the UK credit insurance. And Australia is still not as good as I think it's going to be once the price increases come through. So the underlying momentum is good. Now, some people scratch their head and say, Ollie, I can't believe that. So, because on page 21, your underlying accident year loss ratio has trended up. So can you give me an explanation how I get to reconcile these two items? It's very simple. We have a statistical outlier in here because the accident year loss ratio for the first quarter is heavily impacted by weather-related claims in France and in Germany, a total of about 85 to 90 million that come through tap water. Last year, we also had that, but in Germany, it was in the second quarter, not in the first quarter. On top of that, we have effects from the U.S. you saw, and that lifts this number by more than 1 percentage point relative to what we've seen before. So the underlying, at least from my personal point of view, is actually much better than the number looks on this page. And we expect some further improvements throughout the year. Page number 22, expense ratio stable. That's what it is. Actually, the underlying trend is favorable, particularly in our largest four market. We've taken about 30 to 40 basis points trend improvements. But again, it's the first quarter. And before people relax too much on the expenses, I better shut up and move on to the next slide. Now, average assets base is up to 99 billion, helps us to support the investment income in the low yield environment. Our AIM colleagues are doing a great job to get the right yields despite the challenges in the market. And you also see that on page 24, when you look at the interest and similar income. Now, for those just talking expenses, that this the investment expenses are up, that's also a glitch because we've changed some classifications on the investment expenses in Australia. So no worries about that. That's a transfer. Now, page 25 is changed because we want to give you an appropriate picture on what the price effects have been. Now, in the past, we always used to have two common actual rate change on renewals and then planned pricing. We've eliminated the second also for compliance reasons and signaling going forward. You need to bear with us. We've indicated it with a price trend arrow on the market. Now, we've had about 2% on average, and some commentators have said that's actually a very low number. I don't know what statistics you look at, but I can tell you ours do fully reflect all discounts, and more importantly, the impact of bonus-malus in motor insurance. Many of our competitors publish gross numbers, that is, before bonus and malus. So before you get excited about people that tell you they're increasing prices by 5%, please read the footnotes. Second comment, that while the pricing momentum is positive, we are balancing two items. One is the exposure units, i.e. what is the wording, and the other one is the price. We will work this year both on getting further pricing throughout the year, but also optimizing our risk profile. For example, the experience in Germany with our new product show that we're not just getting better pricing, but better risk selection, which will also affect the claims ratio going forward. So the selection items and tariffing remains hugely important for us, and we're pushing that as well. Last comment, that even though it's my own slide, page 25, I would like to comment on the error in Italy. If I really listen to what I'm hearing from the marketplace, there is pressure building on the pricing, so we might see less pricing strength than this error here indicated. It's probably more going to be flattening out, as you see in the text on the right-hand side. And in non-mortar, we still have fierce competition. I actually don't know why people do that, particularly in commercial lines. We don't have the rates we need to have, so we'll continue to cull risks that are improperly priced. Again, in many other places, prices are improving. Now, let me continue to comment on the credit side. We have some weakening in rates, but we are operating, if I may remind you, at combined ratios below 80%. So we are very comfortable to expand the marketplace, and you see that in our gross numbers. These would be my comments for P&C. In the interest of time, let me move on to life and health. 13.7 billion on the revenue side, operating asset base growing further, operating profit at a solid 800 million, value of new business currently standing at 200 million and a new business margin of 1.9%. Now, the revenue side is depicted on page 28, and there are a couple of comments. Number one, you see the significant reduction in Italy, and that is reflecting lower sales, particularly on the bank insurance side. Now, we had a very, very bad start in January, and as of the end of February, the numbers have been continuously improving. So the trend will revert itself. While we were about 45% below plan in the end of the quarter, we're catching up with now 30% below plan, and we expect to get towards plan through the remainder of the year as the funding situation of the banking partners is actually improving and we're getting a better grip on the right products to sell. Asia Pacific is the other area where I need to comment. With the closure of our Japanese business, significant top line disappears. That's one item. And we have almost irrational competition in Taiwan in the bank assurance side, and therefore we are very cautious to underwrite business. A lot of products with back-end incentives that are problematic, I think, from a customer value standpoint, so we remain on the sidelines. Then somebody wrote we had a strong growth in the U.S. It's not what my numbers say. In the U.S., we're basically flat, slightly up on VA, but that's a last call before repricing on our old product, about 79 million, it was plus 54 million on the VA side, and we have FIA minus 64. Now, and we are really trying to monitor margins here and reprice, and I will comment to that in a second. If you look at the overall structure, the capital strength that we have plays positive on the traditional business side, which we carefully grow, but we're moving particularly from single premium to recurring premium to increase persistency, which helps new business margins despite the fact of lower spread earnings. On the investment-oriented product, that's more difficult to do, and we'd rather let top line go than sell as a negative margin. So with that, I'd like you to move to 29, where you see the development of the present value of new business premiums, which is at a good level of 11.5 billion and the lower new business margin. Now, on the margin, for full transparency, you also know I don't want to kid anybody. This is beginning of period numbers. With the decline of interest rates, the new business margin will also be compressed in the second quarter, and that we need to really watch. And we have a number of measures into place to make sure we sell only profitable product. When you look at page 30, you see the mix of the various markets and the new business margins that we were having in the various segments. You see the lowest number in the United States. That actually is a mix between VA that has been trending before repricing at about zero and good margins on the FIA. After repricing, we will get to new business margin for the U.S. segment of 1 to 125%. And we are targeting overall to grow the life business more, the traditional life business, which has 2 to 3% margin. So we're also adapting the product mix. In terms of the low interest rates, obviously Germany will be trending down in the second quarter, and we'll have to see where that ends up. And numbers of measures are in place to improve the profitability there further. Again, Germany has been the market where we've moved most strongly from single premium to recurring premium business. Page 31 gives you the flows. I mentioned Italy. I think with that, most of the things are said. I expect better net flow numbers for the total year than the first quarter would indicate, in particular because we expect the Italian situation to improve throughout the year. The same should be expected for Asia. Operating profit, page 32, here you see the real improvements, particularly on the investment side. And I would like to comment quickly on expenses and technical. Both look negative. They stem from particularly from adjustments we've done in Germany Life, 10 million from changes in the policyholder allocation for the technical side, and in Germany another 7 million negative true up, like in France. These are one-off effects that I don't expect to come back throughout the year. So then the question is, what should we expect for the technical result over the year? We remain with a target of 800 to 900 million throughout this year, assuming we don't see major changes in lapse behavior, which will affect this and the expense result. Expenses, I expect to be flat over the year at zero. Now, the asset base grows further, and the current yield stays at a good level. In terms of the equity that you see here, we have already a positive contribution from our investment in infrastructure. As you may remember, we are investing significant amounts. And the first large one we did into Gaslet, that's the Norwegian gas pipe, is already contributing upon arrival. I really love that, with 60 million, and that has had a positive effect in the first quarter. Page 34 gives you the overview of the operating investment income, and there were some questions around what happened here. It is, as you can see, in the harvesting side, and we had higher realized gain of around 360 million, particularly on the equity side. And I have to actually compliment our investment managers, because at the end of the first quarter, we locked in gains through the hedges that we have implemented, both particularly in the U.S. and especially in Germany, and made sure that we keep the gain for our policyholders and shareholders and don't lose them with the next market dive. So that is behind the number, not an unusual, an extra one-off item that somebody would normally expect. MCEV development on page 35, nothing unusual this quarter, nothing to write home about. The net free surplus number is significantly down, and we need to move on to the asset management section because I expect there will be some technical items on MCEV anyway, so why spend a lot of time on it? Let's talk about asset management. Now, asset management, very important. We have implemented the organizational change to Allianz Asset Management and are now reporting PIMCO and AGI. We've also used the opportunity, to be honest, to clean up some of the reporting because as we dug in, we found a few assets under management that were actually assets under administration. That's about 50 billion that we have sorted out, and that's important for you to understand as you interpret the historical development. You see the movements on page 38, and I've provided you with quite a few backups in the back to understand what it is. Most important message, no impact on P&L, therefore no restatement of historic AUM figures as shown. It also has no effect on the asset management from shift due to the new structure. Internal growth of total AUM versus end of period December is therefore in adjusted numbers around 5%. Now, if we move on to the net flow numbers on page 39, you see a very strong 23.5 billion in the first quarter, and page 40 does reflect very high earnings despite a low level of performance fees at this point in time out of other net fee and commission income. I'd also like to point out, whatever people say, you get bigger, your margins get smaller. That's not true. The margins have also improved now to a record of 41.7 basis points on the third-party assets. Thank you very much. Now, moving to operating profit in page 41 shows you the driver directly into earnings. The operating expenses reflect, again, the management expenses and the compensation that is fully variable against the earnings. Now, the interesting facts come beyond that on page 42 and 43, where you see the numbers for PIMCO and for AGI. We've highlighted with light blue the new setup numbers that include the total AUMs, the total net flows, and the operating profit. Now, for those of you that think that's a decline in service, we have provided you in the appendix all the data you need on the third-party flows. I'll give you some example when we go to AGI. So you see both in the details of the numbers on total AUM on net third-party flows. We, however, believe the total picture is the right one to look at. Now, let me move from PIMCO, which has stellar numbers, to AGI. And just to give you an example on how you can recalculate, if you want the third-party numbers, the total net flows look at a minus 800 million. The third-party number is 1.6 billion, a positive. So we had a very strong quarter despite some issues. And the Allianz flows that we have had in the segment turned it into negative. So the third-party flows were actually positive. Right-hand side, the operating profit, we are targeting after restructuring a cost-income ratio of below 70%. And the number in the first quarter is reflecting some restructuring cost that will go away over time. So asset management overall, a very good story, good development in both pillars despite the restructuring. With that being said, I'd like to summarize the numbers for the first quarter. A very good start. Two revenues, operating profit up, supported, of course, by lower LatCat. Net income, 1.4 billion, up almost 60%, strong balance sheet. So we maintain our outlook at 8.2 plus or minus 500. And with that, I'm ready to take your questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star or asterisk key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone. Please ensure that the mute function on your telephone is switched off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. If you find that your question has already been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing star 2. Again, please press star 1 to ask a question. Our first question comes from Michael Huttner, JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much. Just a couple of questions. The first one, can you talk a little bit about pricing in German motor? You've got these wonderful rate rises for the Germany as a whole, but German motor, I'd be really interested. The other question is, can you give an idea of what is the underlying run rate for life as a whole? I know you explained that there was about 300 million of gains, but I'm never quite sure how much of that I should attribute to policyholders. I'm coming to a number of about 600 million, but I don't know. Thank you very much.
So these were the couple, right, with a capital C. Michael, good afternoon. The pricing in Germany, we have motor up on the retail side 3.7% and on the commercial side 3.2%. And various other items, and that's the year-to-date rate on renewals. We'll see further effect throughout the years as we hiked up the rate in the beginning of the year, so it's bringing the combined ratio significantly down. It will, however, remain above 100% significantly this year still, because we're coming from a very high level. However, overall, that will have a very significant positive impact on our combined ratio. Now, I'm not quite sure I understood the question on the life insurance side. I would like to remind you of the operating profit outlook that we have provided that by and large gives anywhere between 600 and 700 million operating profit per quarter. So this one was a rather high level, which we believe will revert to the numbers that I mentioned to you earlier, which I think in this interest rate environment is actually very strong.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you very much.
We will now take a question from Andy Broadfield of Barclays. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi, good afternoon. Two questions, please. One, I think Italy there was a few questions asked at various stages with the distress there on the PNC side, what your strategy would be there, and I think you felt that there was good opportunity for organic growth there, which doesn't yet seem to be happening. Is that just a consequence of what you talked a little bit about earlier on the price challenges there? If you can just give a bit more color as to why you haven't made more progress there yet, or whether that's to come, or whether it's unlikely in the current climate. And the second question, just on the VAs, just be helpful to understand a little bit better the practical implications when you say that you've been writing VAs at a margin of zero, I think for a couple of quarters, which you've been dragging down the US new business margins for a while now. Just why that takes so long to turn that through and what the practical implications are.
Yeah. Andy, now let me start with Italy. We are really pushing hard now to grow the units. And after we've really achieved a position where we have the best reserve position and the best profitability in the marketplace, since we have been fairly aggressive in addressing the agencies that were underperforming, it takes quite a while to remotivate them, particularly in a Bersani environment, to give us more top line, but I expect units to improve through the course of this year. The distribution forces do not react as quickly as management would often like it to be. The second thing is there's also been a lot of insecurity in the marketplace and amongst clients and what to do given the distress with Fonsai, which I hope will also clear up over the course of the year. So we remain optimistic around growing the top line in Italy and PNC this year. Now, on the VA side, as we said, we very carefully looked at the results, particularly of the fourth quarter, where not only the in-force business was producing the expected losses, but even the business that we wrote after 2009 recorded a loss, and then very quickly moved to reprice a number of features, get rider fees up, reduce fund choices, and so on. And the issue is that, as you may know, all of these changes need to be filed with regulators in the U.S. That takes about 8 to 10 weeks at a minimum. So the repricing will happen effective in May. And that's why we had some of the last call effects in March that you see here in the numbers. The market will remain extremely tough. given the very, very low level, particularly on the long end, and significant volatility, and therefore the high cost of hedging the riders. Now, we are looking at this extremely carefully and trying to write only the volumes we need to write to support our franchise, but there will be no growth driver here. I personally expect, however, over the course of the year, and that's it's somewhat of a bet, the situation to improve significantly. So the 1%-1.2% new business margin is what we absolutely have to see. Now, by the way, also for economic reasons, our cost of capital is at around 90 basis points to 1 percentage points. Yeah, so that's the margins we have to see across the portfolio.
And there's no other operational techniques to slow the distribution down in that interim period where you're seeking to file changes?
No, it's very difficult to do because you typically have last call effects through your distributors in every channel, particularly in broker dealers. But if you compare what we do relative to what others do, we are actually, strongly advanced in managing the distribution down. There's another thing that we are doing in addition that is actually supporting the changes that are happening on the FIA side, if you have another minute. Yeah, even though I wanted to give you a short answer, because we are with the necessity to register FIAs, with registered reps, we are successfully convincing the more sophisticated sales forces to sell FIA and traditional life products in addition to VA. This takes a while, and we support that transition to the minimum needed with VA.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right.
Our next question comes from Mr. Hawking of Morgan Stanley.
Good afternoon, everybody. Can I just ask two questions on Solvency II, please? What is the ultimate forward rate you're using for the curve in Germany on the life side? And can you just comment a little bit on what the most uncertain areas are from your point of view that are outstanding, both on the standard form and also in your negotiations with BaFin on the internal model? Thank you.
I haven't really fully understood the second part of your questions, Will. The only thing I understood was the ultimate forward rate, which is 4.2%, so that much I can answer off the cuff.
So the second part was about where you think the most uncertain areas are in the current draft.
Ah, okay. Now, the most uncertain area is what, if any, will be the substitution for the liquidity premium that was introduced with QRS4 and QRS5 as a counter effect to the high volatility and as a reflection of the illiquidity of our liabilities. Remember, the purpose that insurance has in society is not just to transfer risk from an individual into a community of risks, but also provide illiquid liabilities that you can then invest for the long run and ignore short-term volatility. Unfortunately, Solvency II, because it's modeled on stupid Basel II principles, has failed to get that appropriately in. The industry tried to do that with the liquidity premium that has been not so successful. Now the question, what will be the substitute? Because our liabilities, just to take P&C as an example, are indeed illiquid, and therefore a mark-to-market modeling of the liabilities is not appropriate. We at this point do not know whether and how there will be a CCP. We have a joint industry position. We have particularly said we need predictability, i.e. it needs to be formula-based and not based on some whim of some bureaucrat sitting in some agency somewhere. And the second thing is we need to appropriately reflect, and that's in the matching adjustment, and that's not an add-on, but either-or, the illiquidity of our liabilities that, again, is most easy to answer for all P&C liabilities. You might remember that very few clients burn their houses on purpose in order to get cash from an insurer or drive their cars into the wall. And on the life insurance side, we have large amounts of products that have factual prevention of surrenders and therefore do not need to be worried much about spread movements. This is unclear what we're going to happen. This is the most important thing that needs to get reconciled. To be honest, even though I'm chairing the CFO forum, I can't tell you where this is going to come out.
So just to clarify, on slide 69, one of the reconciling items, it mentions the mitigating effect of the countercyclical premium. So are you giving yourself the benefit of the CCP, even though it's contingent at the moment?
What we have done is to do outside of Europe. We have not applied it to the European books. We've only applied it to Korea and the U.S., and it is not a double whammy of what most people do. If you want any technical details, please talk to Olli Schmidt going forward. He will explain you how we have been applying it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah?
We will now take a question from Paul Goodhand of Redburn. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Oliver. Two questions, please. On the U.S. non-life business, you talked about further reserve additions in the quarter. Could you quantify how large they were, and I guess it's the usual suspects in terms of lines of business, but maybe you give us some detail on that. And the expense reduction program, I think, is the core part of the improvement plan there over the long term. How's that going? And on the pricing, thank you for making that important point about the pricing that you give being net of bonus malus. What would be interesting would be to give the figure growth of that effect so we can see what the difference is and then perhaps compare you more easily with some competitors.
Number one, we don't disclose individual line of business reserve additions. What I can tell you is that workers' compensation in the U.S. remains an issue because medical inflation, particularly in the state of California, is trending significantly above long-term averages. We haven't done dramatic reserve increases in the first quarter. We're just bringing the accident year loss ratio up as we're taking higher loss picks as expected. And I cannot exclude that further reserve reviews throughout the year might require reserve additions. However, no firm numbers have been determined. We need to look at the reserve reviews in the second quarter and the third quarter to look at that. My overall point is, some have been betting on the U.S. numbers to be dramatically improving throughout 2012. I'd like to remind you of what I said at the end of 2011. The U.S. will remain a challenge for all of 2012. Now, in terms of the gross of bonus malus, I actually do not know. We'll try to look that up. And I will get back to you on that because we have different bonus malus crediting rates across the various countries, and we have made it a good, I think, practice to exclude them for quite a while. I just happened to find that out because we have new colleagues on the board and some of them coming from other companies where they have other practices.
Cool, thanks.
We will now take a question from Brian Shea of Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I have two questions, please. First of all, on your net price increase of 2%, I'm just wondering how that compares to claim inflation. In other words, as we look out a year or 2 years, can we hope that the price increases are enough that they alone should be driving a better combined ratio, or is it the case that you're really just kind of breaking even with respect to claim inflation? And then secondly, PIMCO had a very good quarter. Nevertheless, the incentive payments were also low in the quarter. Dare we hope that we're getting towards the end of the B unit expenses being high? Maybe you could just tell us what the schedule is for incentive payments going forward over the next year or so. Thank you.
Yep. In order to understand the net effect of claims inflation and pricing, if you take the dynamics over the last four quarters, we had about 10 to 20 basis points net productivity gain of prices over that. Only this quarter, because of the tap water claims and a few others, this number is somewhat distorted. Yeah. So if you take the average. The second thing is people always compute when we set the reserves and the prices with 3%, we're also structurally changing the portfolio. In my estimates, we have about a continuation of this 10 to 20 basis points productivity improvement over the next 4 to 5 quarters. However, with oscillation around that number. So to summarize, we should see a positive effect of prices net of claims movement. That's at least what is in our plans. Let's see that our operators deliver that. Now, on the B units, we have about 200 million remaining costs to come, and the cash outflow, because we have been reserving for some of them already, is around 700 million. So, Brian, that's a small number relative to the cash earnings that we're getting. Yeah. So it's really true we're coming to the end of the story. Now, the program still runs in 2016, but the numbers are going to get less and less and less relevant.
Can you, I'm sorry to be so pedestrian about this, but for 2012, any suggestion on what we should pencil into our models for the B units for 2012?
Very small amount, I don't know.
I'll take it up with IR.
Let me just remind you what the drivers is: the operating profit growth, which in the first quarter was below what we historically had. That's why we had a lower multiple. Remember, we have two types of multiples that kick in. So I don't know what the number is, but somebody will soon tell me. I just get that from our chief accountant, around 190 million for the September call. Units, 191. So the unit matters here. To be honest, Brian, I seem to be mentally absent, and the reason why is it is totally irrelevant.
All right, I'll take that up with IR. Thank you.
Totally irrelevant.
Yeah, but happy to follow up on this, Brian.
It's not a material number anymore, and I think this is really the important news. As I said, there's not much you need to model around that.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Michael Haid of MainFirst Bank. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Two questions. First on Fireman's Fund. I would like to get a better understanding on what's going on. You mentioned there are some reserve additions. Should we expect these reserve additions coming through every quarter? Why don't you do it in one hit if they are expected anyway? And can you give us also an update on the restructuring measures that you have taken? How do they work? How do they perform? Second, on the risk result in life health insurance, which has come under pressure in this first quarter. Can you give us the reasons for this? Of course, I understand that you have a huge portfolio here, but maybe there are some reasons. And also, do recently written contracts offer higher risk results, or is there competition which drives down the risk result going forward?
Now, the first thing I'd like to mention is that this is statistical noise. Sorry to disappoint you, but there is no extrapolation of the first quarter that makes any sense for the annual result. We had a number of true-ups we've done in Germany in one or two countries that had a negative effect here. I expect a more positive development throughout the year. As mentioned earlier, we should get to the 800 to 850 million minimum risk result for the year. So that's what you should bear in mind, and there's going to be volatility around that as we do update, and the risk results are not coming down. We're actually incentivizing taking better risk results going forward, and there will be more incentives in the portfolio and for our sales forces to sell risk products. However, let's be very careful. In the 25 years that I've seen in the industry, whenever interest rates were low, people were piling into disability and other health products to just 5 years later wake up and be saddled with huge losses. So what looks like a good new business margin now turned out to be a significant headache later. Yeah. Now, second comment I have on the Fireman's Fund. We have already done a huge reserve addition exercise last year. I was personally involved with Oscar Bucher, a new chief actuary. We've done everything that the data at that point in time indicated. Now, in the meantime, the U.S. market in some areas has actually further deteriorated, and we are doing our reviews as we speak, and in the second quarter you'll have more information to come. How is the restructuring proceeding? We have two items. Number one is addressing the cost base. Our loss ratio in the U.S. is actually fairly good, but the issue is scale and a very significant cost base. The costs have come down significantly already in the first quarter, and we have cost reduction plans in place for the remainder of the year. So far, they're working as planned. The other one, we must take rate, particularly on the property side in commercial lines, and where we can take rate, we need to let the risks go. The U.S. market is still not where it needs to be, but there are first signs of rate strengthening in property. The liability lines are more of a problem still, not just workers' compensation, and there we are separating ourselves with a number of segments that are not producing the appropriate returns. I'm very confident. I met with my colleague Gary Bogwani yesterday that Gary and team are doing exactly the right things to fix the ship.
So is it fair to assume that a fireman's fund result will be in the second quarter worse than what you expect for the third and fourth quarter?
I don't know about the timing, yeah, but the combined ratio for the year will stay above 100%.
Okay. Thank you very much.
William Hawkins of KPW will ask our next question.
Thank you very much. Hello. Two questions, please. First of all, my favorite one on slide 35, where you've got your MCEV. Could you tell us how much of the MCEV was not recognized on the IFRS balance sheet?
Yes, I've been waiting for that.
Well, I wanted to please you, Oliver. And then secondly, while I've got my nerd hat on slide 42, I'm just interested, when you're showing your three-year outperformance, as you flag, there's been an adjustment to how you calculate it. And that kind of implies that the three-year outperformance in PIMCO has improved to that 96%. At the end of last year, the data on a like-for-like basis was showing a deterioration. And so I'm just wondering, is there a genuine improvement going on, or is it just that the numbers have changed? And can you just try to give us a like-for-like?
Yeah, the other, there is a genuine improvement because we had a V, yeah, it was down and then came back up because our master, Bill Gross, really found the recipe again. So it's back up and it's a genuine improvement. Second, the number of the shareholder value not accounted for in IFRS equity, I'm sorry for the last call, I just didn't understand the question, but that was my fault, has moved from 1.677 billion in the first quarter of 11 to 2.645 in the first quarter of 12.
2.645, very accurate, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Our next question comes from Jean-François Tremblay of RBC. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I have two questions, please. First of all, on the life business, you alluded during your comment, Oliver, to a number of initiatives you're taking to protect new business margins in the second quarter. So during the call, you talked about what you're doing on your U.S. VA book. Is there anything else you're doing to prevent this further pressure on new business margins? And then the second question on the P&C business. So you recorded the price increases of 3.8% in the quarter in France, one of the markets with the strongest rate momentum. How sustainable do you think these rate movements are going to be in the French market?
Okay, let me start with the second. I don't know. I only know what the facts are and that we are trying to take rates, particularly on the commercial line side. We'll have to see how the market reacts. Currently, it has been supportive. So from what I know for the second quarter, we have some more positive momentum, but I cannot predict anything for three and four. Second, on the life business, the laws of physics will hold, gentlemen, right? So people that tell you that this interest rate environment, new business margins can be protected in a way that they will not come down, that's unrealistic. Yeah, with the record low interest rates, particularly in Germany and the U.S., we will see some further decline. Now, what are we doing? The first one is in Germany, to give you a couple of examples, to make sure that we have the right mix between single premium and recurring premium. We've been de-emphasizing single premiums, particularly in the corporate side, and moving to recurring premiums, also because competitors are willing to price risks at different prices than we price them. Yeah, the corporate clients are more sensitive to the lock-in bonuses. That gives me the second point. In Germany, you can decide whether you lock in bonuses on an annual basis or you move it to the final bonus account. Moving it to the final bonus account has two advantages. You can claim them back, and secondly, they count as risk capital. That is not highly appreciated by large corporate clients, but makes huge impact in terms of profitability. We're rather foregoing price-elastic corporate money and protecting our capital and our margin. That gives you as two examples of what we do. In France, for example, we are pushing very hard the health side and the businesses that we do understand there relative to plain vanilla business. So we're doing a number of things across markets to protect the margin as much as possible. But again, you know me, I don't give you the baloney thing. The margins will come down in the second quarter relative to what we've seen.
Okay, thank you.
We will now take a question from Anna Tanasos Pantarotas of Chevreux. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon to everybody. I have just one follow-up question on the life business. My question was very similar to the former one. I saw the sensitivity table of your life EV at end of 2011, and your German new business value should go down by 84% in the case of 50 basis point decline of interest rates. Now, my question is it possible that you will get up to some premiums in order to defend your margin in the future, so likely to reducing materially your single premium? The second question is on dividends. You mentioned at early before the presentation that it's too early to pay to increase the dividend given the uncertainty. But let's assume that the Solvency II final framework will be quite favorable for the industry. Do you think that you could revise upward your payout ratio of roughly 40% as you used in the past? Thank you.
Yeah, I would like to reiterate a couple of points on the dividends. Let's start with that. Number one, in normal years, we have always said we have about a 40% distribution because we believe we can invest the money profitably. That might change between segments, i.e. more in P&C and asset management versus less on life, depending on what the interest rate environment is, and more in markets where we can take strong margins like Eastern Europe, for example, than in mature markets. And people have every incentive to produce positive margins. We don't give any credit. And actually, if people want to sell business at new business margins of zero or below, they need explicit permission from the corporate center to actually do sell, just to be very clear, right? And it has severe consequences if people are selling at negative margins. So I think this is really important. The other thing is that is always a beginning of period number. You need to think through what that means over as it moves over the quarter. That's why I said some of those numbers will go down. And yes, as you see in our top line, we are prepared to let top line go in order to protect the bottom line. We'd rather be fully transparent and as opposed to having super optimistic assumptions. Now, the other thing I'd also like to say in terms of new business margins, just to put a little bit of salt on the whole cake here, I see a lot of new business margins that are consistent with the MCEV framework, but have very interesting policyholder behavior assumptions baked into, which you as an investor cannot really challenge. So whether that's lapse assumptions and all kinds of other things, we try to be extremely conservative on those and don't try to have businesses that look good, have high new business margin, but assume 40 to 50% lapse ratios that either create a problem if they don't come for shareholders and if they come create a issue from a regulatory standpoint. So just as an industry observer, I would like to say that we need to strike the right balance between customer benefits and shareholder benefits, and we do not want to sell products that are ripping off clients, just to put it bluntly. Now, let's move. And then you had another question. I think dividends, I think we've addressed for now. Again, let's see how the year goes through. And a final reminder, we are in Germany. We have the supervisory board deciding what the dividend proposal is.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Nick Holmes of Nomura. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Thank you very much. I just had a couple of questions. First is coming back to US Life and the big decrease in the margin. I wondered, can you tell us how much is due to the variable annuities and how much to other products? And can you also say again what exactly it is that you've changed in the repricing of the products? And then second question is looking at economic solvency. I wondered whether the rather high sensitivity to interest rates excludes the use of the RSB. And I asked the question just because I'd have thought the RSB as a capital buffer would be much more effective in neutralizing interest rate risk. Thank you.
Well, the guys are looking up the details for what the repricing measures are. I think this was a host of things, Nick, that was done on VA. So, for example, increasing rider fees, limiting fund choices. I think there's a whole slew of things. And
did you take your guarantee rate down, for example?
Yeah, and we have done some adjustments in terms of roll-up rates and so on and so forth. I'll give you the details in a second while the team is looking at it.
Okay.
So you can compare to what others have done. I think that's the background. I'm more comfortable with the choices because, again, I don't want to bank on behavioral assumptions being more benign than really hedging results in others. Now, on the RFB use in Germany, RFB generally is an accounting construct, and the interest rate sensitivity is based on an economic view. Now, we do have the ability to use the free policyholder funds to, of course, support times of low interest rates. And by the way, it also supports new business strain as this is available for funding. Now, and it's really, really important to understand that this gives us a huge competitive advantage in the industry. The second thing that is also coming in on local GAAP accounting is the additional low interest rate reserve, which is hitting a lot of competitors with huge amounts as the numbers come down, because we can fund them not just through superior investment income, but also the way the reserves are being used and allocated to policyholder funds. So it's not just a general observation on interest rate risk, but in particular, it helps us to produce more attractive returns to our policyholders relative to what the competition can do. Now, on your specific question on the US, what the new business margins have been in comparison separated out between VA and the fixed index annuity, which are the two largest line, the fourth quarter numbers, as a reminder, were 84 basis points on the VA and 1.9% of the fixed index annuity for a total of 1.6. In the first quarter, the VA number, as said earlier, trended towards zero, the FIA at 108 for a total of 80 basis points. And that's why we instituted the repricing to bring the total back to 1.25% as of May. We have two or three major items that were implemented to limit the choice to less volatile funds, to increase the rider fees, and to, in particular, increase the guarantee fees. And by the way, not just on new business, but also on the in-force. I hope that helps.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Just very quickly on the RFB, just to clarify, it is not used as a risk mitigant in your interest rate sensitivity, in your economic solvency.
No, it is indeed used.
It is indeed. Okay, so it is used, right?
Of course.
Right. Okay, but the sensitivity does seem to be very high, considering that you've got all of that RFB, you know, 14 billion or whatever it is, but that's how the numbers work out.
Yes, and the business, given the duration gap that we have historically had, that's how the numbers move because of the very high convexity. Now, just to address that, we have put a program into place to lengthen the duration a part of, by the way, of the increase we had on the Italian govies is coming from that duration lengthening program that will reduce the mathematical sensitivity of the number. Now, some people will say, well, you're taking more credit risk on that. We're taking more credit spread risk. I don't think default risk. And because of our strong RFB position, this is, by the way, another aspect, we can afford to take that risk without having to worry and still get the economic benefit of slowly but surely closing the duration gap.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Now, by the way, were you referring to the shock, Nick? Because I'm really trying to answer your question precisely. You were referring to the shock scenarios? If you were referring to the shock scenarios, I'd just like you to be reminded of the fact that we don't anchor the rates in the shock scenarios.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking of, the interest rates moving down by 100 basis points.
Yeah,
which...
And we don't really anchor it. So the anchoring effect is not in there because we want to provide a more honest perspective. Thank you for asking that, and Tom, thank you for making that point. We would understate the risk effect if we were then sort of in parallel. Then it would not be a stress, right? It doesn't make any sense. So whether you believe me or not, we're really trying to provide a fairly pure economic view on what the stress scenarios are.
Okay. So the full effect then of a capital cushion is not really included, fully included.
Yeah, because the question is, do you have a short-term shock?
Yes.
Or do you have a longer-term decline? What most people are worried about is not the short-term shock, but the longer-term decline in the Japanese scenario. And then the question is whether rates will come back. And we had the argument in the past, and I'd like to reiterate, we need to worry about the next 10 to 15 years and what happens to interest rates, maybe 20 years, but worrying about cash flow that will happen once I'm long dead and my children will be retired. I personally believe from how do I manage the book is, at least in terms of modeling, less relevant to make sure that we have the cash flow to support the guarantees. And maybe let me reiterate that I have everybody on board, and despite trying to give short answers, the key thing is in a 1.5% interest rate scenario that we are in, do we ever have a problem in Germany to honor our guarantees? And the answer is never. Okay? With the digital interest rate reserve, never, just to get it out of the system.
Yeah, understand. Thank you very much for that.
All right.
We would now like to take a question from Christian Moschik of Sylvia Quant Research. Please go ahead.
Hello, it's Christian Moschik from Sylvia Quant Research. Thank you for letting me ask that question. It quite nicely melts into the previous question. So, how do you react to the current low interest rate environment, especially in German life? Would it be fair to assume that you further increase your loan portfolio, loan investments, mortgage investments, what to model as a new investment yield that would be really great to know. Thank you.
So we're doing quite a few things, and you might have observed that. Number one, the first thing that is very important is what do we not do? That is buying bonds, by and large, because we really believe that a bubble has been built there quite significantly, like in the U.S. And then it's very important to understand what are we investing at? What are the yields that we're earning on new money? And they're significantly above what we need for the guarantees. On the life side, that's 3.5%, and that is what we are looking for. And the second thing is we are trying to find the right mix. We are really looking at expanding the covered bonds and the corporate side, and then some buying some ABS. We're expanding the real estate side, and in particular like to do more on infrastructure. And on the lending side, we confine ourselves by and large to real estate lending, which, by the way, we have about 40 years in history of doing. Now, people are saying, why haven't you done it in the last 10 years? Now, why are you back? Let me give you maybe an interesting answer. When we were doing the lending, the banks had about the same leverage in their balance sheet as we had, 1 to 10. And then they moved from a leverage of 1 to 10, where they still are today, to 1 to 30. And because of spreads seemingly disappearing, they had applied very low cost of capital. Even then, they lowered prices on the lending even further because some of the large banks said, well, let's cross-subsidize the lending and make the money on the investment banking fees. Now, that was before 2008. What we now see is deleveraging, so cost of capital from the capital amounts going up, cost of capital for banks going up dramatically, and that's very, very important, no more cross-subsidies of credit businesses. Now, clients don't find that to be very attractive, but at the same time, we need to acknowledge that credit pricing was far below where it needed to be. And where now rates are appropriate relative to the risk and the equity capital that we economically need to apply, we go back in and find more rational competition today than we saw in the past. On top of that, you have deleveraging even of some good assets in the banking side, as banks have to repair their balance sheet and not just get more capital and get more liquidity, since we are ideally positioned with our long-duration liabilities, particularly on the life side. We're very happy to do long-term lending if the appropriate returns are there and the appropriate securities. Sorry for the longer-winded answer, but that's why we are looking at it again, not because it's new, but we now find more appropriate conditions to do the lending. I actually expect more to come because initially we've now seen over the last year a lot of fire sale assets with problematic risk return profiles, and we're not in the, how do I say that, vulture fund business. That's for others to do. We want really good assets at the appropriate prices with nice duration, and we haven't seen too much of that yet. I believe with further deleveraging on the banking side having to happen, there will be more supply of good assets for us to take a look at. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, one short afterward. So you wouldn't rule out or you look at portfolios which are on the market, let's say, for example, from EuroHypo or stuff like that, and if pricing would be correct, you would consider buying that?
We look... I wouldn't comment on any specific bank.
Yeah, sure. Just it was an example.
We constantly look at portfolios, to be honest. We haven't found appropriately priced risk on the in-force because the in-force book of banks often is mispriced. And it's very tough for a bank to sell a mispriced credit book because they would then have to give us money on top. That hasn't happened yet. It might happen. We'd rather look for new business that is appropriately priced.
Brilliant. Thank you.
More common sense than brilliant, but...
Well...
All right, next question, please.
Our next question comes from Thomas Seidel of Sanford Bernstein. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hello, good afternoon. Two questions on the non-life side again. I think you led us through the premium and the rate change per country, and I think it looks like in Germany and France, Allianz continues to lose market share, and I think I heard you saying that you expect some change. I wonder what type of actions you have planned and what sort of what timetable you are looking at here. And the other question on non-life was on the assets backing the liabilities, slide 23. Given the short duration, or the shorter duration compared to the life side, shouldn't we expect a bit of more of a decline on the fixed interest income?
Yeah, let me answer the last question. The current yield on the P&C side indeed is around 3%, i.e. lower than what we see on the life side. That's the first question. And again, we are being impacted here by what we see. I personally believe we should go longer in the duration because of the stability of the cash flow. That's not quite consistent with what Solvency II says, but is more consistent with economic thinking because of the stability that we indeed have. And we have done some of duration lengthening there in order to get some yield pickup. Now, to the more specific question, what do we do in Germany and France in order to avoid losing market share? Now, there's the one view is on the customer, i.e. the number of risk units. And there you are correct. We are taking positive pricing momentum, to be precise. In the first quarter, we had around 130 million price benefit in Germany, and don't know exactly the number, 80 to 90 million customer volume loss. I think it's 99 million. That's the volume impact. So we have the price effect outperforming the volume effect, and we need to do two things. Number one, and we have been successfully doing that, we need to diversify the channel architecture. We're now growing very strongly in the direct area through Altecur and through our online agency business, which is called AAOS. It's both doing very well, in addition to bringing up productivity on the agency side. And what we're currently seeing is that productivity on P&C overall is picking up. On top of that, also in commercial lines through the broker channel. And that's by and large what we have to do in France too, even though there the online market is much more in infant stage than it is in Germany. On top of that, I'd like you to understand that we are strongly working on strengthening our automotive distribution. We have formed a global automotive unit. Significant part of the new business in Germany, the pure new car sales, are going through car dealers. Allianz is the leading provider there, and we've been very strong in improving not just volumes but also profitability by restructuring the portfolios. For example, the true retail business is fairly profitable. We've been losing money in the past is on the car dealer coverages that we've either repriced or discontinued. So pushing that through, and we're doing that also in France with international corporations. Germany, by the way, it's not just Volkswagen, it's Daimler and a number of other brands. We are doing the same thing across other markets. The last item is product redesign. In Germany, we've done Mein Auto, Our Car, which is a modular product that is fairly consistent, by the way, can over time be consistently replicated between and across different technology platforms that allows clients, together with their advisors or by themselves, to plug and play. So the base cover is fully competitive with the low price competition, and the modular approach allows clients to pick and choose the additional coverages, which, by the way, also reduces admin costs for us and brings more margin for the carrier. So that's what I'd like to say. I'm fairly comfortable that we will succeed here. Given the overall poor state, however, in terms of profitability in motor in Germany, to really come through, we need to see, again, more rational competition. Now, with late rates, interest rates, that is, being at an ultra-low level, I hope some rational behavior finally also makes it into the German market, and the signs are positive. The same for France, where we've seen significant pricing action as discussed. So that would be my answer.
Okay, thank you.
So it's 25 minutes past. We have time to take one more question, please.
Our final question today will come from Julia Raffo of Autonomous Research. Please go ahead.
Julia, how nice to hear from you.
Thank you very much. I have a few questions. First, on capital, am I right that it's impossible to get your economic solvency based on the old 99.97 confidence level?
Yes, it's impossible.
Okay, and then a follow-up just on capital based on your 99.5. Is it possible to have a sense for how much is the impact on the of the liquidity premium in the solvency ratio? Then my second question is on
yes,
your...
Can I answer that?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, if we have... If we take the worst case, we take out the liquidity premium and the yield curve anchoring, the latter, which, by the way, makes no sense whatsoever,
yeah,
it would be around 150. By the way, the liquidity premium, Julia, I mentioned at the beginning, has come down very significantly from 96 point something to 50 something. So that means almost half. So the benefit of that is actually very less significant than it was in the past. Okay?
Yeah, is it possible to have that in isolation, so from 202 instead of going all the way to 150, just 70?
Yes, and Olli Schmidt will give that number to you if you may after the call. I'm always using the worst case and say,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, no, that's fine. I'm not trying to mix. Yeah, that's fine. My second question is on your banking exposure. If I read your interim statement correctly, you slightly reduce your banking debt exposure, but within that, you increase by about 1 billion your tier 1 exposure. Can you just confirm that, and can you give us a sense of what type of tier 1 geography wise did you buy? And then my final question is on the pricing slide. There is a food.
Can I answer? Sorry.
Yes, of course. Of course.
It's not an investment, but a fair value increase.
Ah, okay. So it's just simply a mark-to-market movement.
Yes. No additional investment
okay.
in banks. Otherwise, I would be panicking around here.
Yeah, that's why I found the two a bit in contrast. So I just wanted to get clarification. And my final question is on your pricing slide.
Yes,
in the footnote, you seem to say that the 2% exclude the AGCS. And I think before you used to include your AGCS.
No, we never had that in. I'm actually trying to get we actually didn't have the actual rate change on renewals in the past. And that's why we always showed it on the right-hand side. We had both the credit insurance side, Julia, and AGCS next to the table. We now, because we have comparable data on the actual rate change on renewals, moved it in here. And that's really important because that explains the comparison to the old numbers. So actually, the quality of the numbers has improved, not decreased.
So it's a more conservative view, you
yes.
can argue. Yeah. Okay. And yes. I just wanted to clarify because the full year slide was basically saying that the price renewal impact was including credit, but I didn't appreciate that AGCS was excluded. So
yes.
that's
and
all clear.
And it's very important because, again, the credit is negative, so it brings the averages down.
Yeah.
And in AGCS, we have a very heterogeneous picture across the globe. That's why we provided you with additional information. The total, if you exclude AGCS and credit, is 2.4. And let me differentiate even retail from commercial. The retail side is trending more towards 3% and less strong, less than 2% on commercial. This is, by the way, where we need to see the biggest pickup. I'm always amazed how slowly commercial markets move, but they have to move. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now, Olli Schmidt was very strict. Olli, this is really it? Do I need to finish?
Yes. If you have more questions, please call the team, but I think we should close the call for now.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us.
Now you know who's really in charge with that. Goodbye. And if you have more questions, give us a shot.
Okay.
All the best.
Thanks. Bye-bye.